This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Book in Secularism, a channel of the New Books Network. My name is Yakir Englander, your host today. Many times we make a distinction between profane or secular and the holy. So how can it be that deeply religious poetry is being written by a committed socialist, literary revolutionary and modernist? How sacredness appears in working in the field? How one can pray after the death of God? This magical contradiction is being explored and explained in the book Abraham the Hebrew Believer, Secularism and Holiness in the Work of Avraham Shlonsky. The book is a journey to the world of one of the most creative figures in modern Hebrew culture. And our guest today is Dr. Rani Yeager, who is a scholar and educator at the Shalom Hartman Institute in Jerusalem, and the co-founder and rabbi, or maybe should we say secular rabbi, of Bet Tfilah Israeli in Tel Aviv.
Rani, welcome to the New Books Network.
It's great to be here, Yakir.
Thank you. So today we're going to speak about questions that are very relevant, in my opinion, to our lives. You know, there are so many constructions of words that we're using, like this is religious, this is profane, or this is secular. We speak about living in the city compared to living in nature, and what holiness is. And the gift with your book that you go to one of the unbelievable poet. I don't know exactly how to identify Shlonsky, and I would love you to do it. And in a way, his literature and his poetry and his short articles are opening new ideas or new definitions around the so familiar definitions. So, Rani, as we start, a few words about who was Avraham Shlonsky.
Okay, so he was born at the beginning of the 20th century. It was very meaningful for him that he was exactly born in 1900, you know, at the beginning of the century, like a newborn kid to a newborn century. Grew up in a small city in the Ukraine His parents' home was something that was very appealing for me, because his father was more religiously traditional, even though not strict, but still very much affiliated with Jewish tradition, and it was very important for him. And his mother was a communist. So he's describing in one of his beautiful poems that in his parents' bookshelf, you can find the Bible on one side, or Maimonides on one side, and Lenin, and you know, or you know, some Russian avant-garde anarchist writing on the other side, looking one upon the other.
Right.
So I know, you know, because so many times we think of these people as coming from traditional homes, but they're all, he was one of those people, one of those persons that already came from a very, I would say, vibrant, open, winds from many corners of that European moment. He when he was 12 years old, he went to Palestine to study Hebrew in a college here, in a Hebrew college, which is also crazy. You think of the beginning of the century being so far away with all the low communication of those times, had to go back because of the First World War, and then came back as a pioneer, as part of those movements of Jews from Eastern and Western Europe to the land of Israel to start something new. And it was very interesting. We're speaking about holiness. So he never went, as so many of his peers, he never went to the holy sites, to the old holy sites, to Jerusalem, or the famous holy places
of Tiberia. Yeah.
Yes, none of them. He went to the Jezreel Valley, which is not that important. It is, but for them, that was the sacred place where they worked in the land, on the land, being farmers and recreating the land and also themselves. Though very quickly, being despised by his comrades, he published his first poem. Because for his comrades, that was bourgeois, right? You had to work. You shouldn't have write poems. But, that was his spirit. And so after a while, he moved to the city and quite quickly became, you said, define him. I would say not only a writer, a poet, I would say an architect of culture, because an architect is not only the person who is actually putting the bricks, but someone who designs the home that other people can live in. So he was the editor of so many literary supplements from the 30s till his death in 73, from the great poets of modern Hebrew poetry. He was probably the one who had published, gave the first publishing moment for dozens of poets, that he was the person that not discovered them, but gave them a way to,
like the stage to publish their
poetry. Exactly.
Incredible.
So he's not only the one who published himself and wrote like the six volumes of poems, but he was also the creator of those, realms where you could publish yourself. And also he was very much influenced with the rejuvenation of Hebrew, inventing words. He was like the master of language inventions. They needed, his wife at those times was an actor in theater, and they lacked Hebrew words for theater because there was no theater for centuries, right? No. So they said to him, all the things that we say in French, regisseur, I don't know what, how would we call them? And this crazy guy simply invented the words, but he usually did not invent them. He borrowed them from ancient sources. Like, this is crazy to our discussion about holiness and secularism, everything that you mentioned in the beginning. He borrowed almost all the words that were renewed by him for artifacts or moments of modern Hebrew theater came from scripture, from the description of the temple in the book of Leviticus. So he simply borrowed words that were previously describing the priests that were performing. But he said, we are the priests, we're performing. Oh, so God. Once you had seen, the great moments of revelation were conducted by priests or prophets. I'm borrowing and reusing this language. And it was, of course, it was all designed like that for him. It wasn't coincidental. It was to tell you and to tell the audience that this is no entertainment. Of course, there was also entertainment, and he loved entertainment. He was a very, cheerful guy. But at the same time, he knew that things that they were doing were religious and holy in the sense that they give meaning. So, and maybe I'll stop here. I mean, there are many more other things to say, but this is like...
So I have so many questions that come to my mind, and I want to start with a very technical, just for maybe listeners who knows a little bit about Hebrew poetry. So we speak here, we all know the poet Bialik, and so he's like the second he's like the generation after, right?
After one, yes. And actually he was rebelling against Bialik while admiring him.
Okay, so we have Bialik and I guess like Berdichevsky there, the third generation, right? And Gnesin also, can we put them in the same kind of time?
We can.
And then where he's next to Brenner, to Rachel, who is writing poetry then.
He's next.
Where he is, he's with Lech, because he's until 1973, so it's probably very hard to say.
The 30s and 40s were his high, and 50s also. Or his highest, you know, the tide of Shlonsky's time.
Yes.
And actually there is a whole generation in literary scholarship, which is not my thing, but I can see what they talk about. They call it the Shlonsky-Alterman generation. Shlonsky on one side.
Nathan Alterman, who was
actually his like younger brother, but at the end of the day, even sometimes more I don't know, talented, but certainly more popular. So they're described as a one generation, you know, as one generation of writers. And around them, of course, there were many great. Leah Goldberg that you mentioned. By the way, Leah Goldberg, speaking about architecture, right? So he, not only we talked before about real life, so he was trying to help her to immigrate to Israel, you know, with all the forms and bureaucracy. So he was in that as well. It's not only in writing. And at the same time, you know, when she she disembarked the ship in the port, the first thing that she got descending from the ship that brought her to Eretz Israel was her first book that he printed for her. Can you imagine a young woman, intellectual from Vilnius, coming to another country, writing Hebrew there.
Already there, yes.
Already there, and he knew her from there, and he had high esteem for her work. And she is now disembarking the ship, and the first thing that greets her is Shlonsky and her book in print.
What a sensitivity.
This was a gesture she never forgot. At the same time, she opened the book and she saw all kinds of editing that he's done in her poetry, and she started crying. You see, so this whole... Okay, so...
Incredible, yeah. Incredible. And the second thing that you said, and now I want to go deeper, is you said that in a way, for example, he's inventing Hebrew by going to the past. So it's like he's creating the future by going to the past.
Yes.
I was thinking to speak about that later, but since we speak about past and future, let's do it now. Can you share a little bit about this relationship? Because Shlonsky, some people who will look at that in a simplicity way, will say he is part of the secular group of Israelis, but he is so much more nuanced. And I would love you, Rani, if you can please speak with us about how much Israeli and Jewish secularism, at least in Palestine that became later the state of Israel, they are really cutting themselves from the past, and how much Shlonsky actually speaking with the past in order to create the secular future. And maybe even the word secular is not the right word. So I think I would need you to help us to find better words for that. And last thing, whenever you feel that you want to read for us a few lines from Shlonsky, please do it.
Do it in a moment. I have to tell you that one of the reasons that I dived back into his work, which I knew a little bit of, but now I know much more, is because I was personally interested with these questions. And it was for me like sort of a psychoanalysis, because he was so central as a writer, but also as an architect of culture, so that I felt that in order to understand who we are and what are we dealing with, you know, each problems, you know, pro and con, right? Good and also critical way. Shlonsky provides a fantastic look back and forward, exactly as you said, because I think coming from the home that he came from, with the two parents that I described, and also his own personality, of course, he was insisting that the whole trick of this new thing, which is which he was part of, and that was part of the creation here, was that it had to be old and new at the same time. That if it's only looking backwards and it's only traditional, then it's simply irrelevant, because you can't leave the past. And if you think you're doing that, you're just imagining that you're actually living the past, because you're not in the past. At the same time, he had like this deep resentment to the, as much as he was a revolutionist, and also with the Russian background and everything, he couldn't bear the people or the, you know, the attitude that was just looking forward with no leaning on the past. That, that it couldn't work for him as a committed Jew, as a, you know, as a pioneer. I think also as a person, as a cultural figure, the moment that you say culture, also especially in Europe, then there is some sort of bond between past and future. And here I do want to, and by the way, before we read this little paragraph, I would like to say that for him, exactly the thing that, you know, walking between the drops, if you can say that, walking between the tensions, that for people seem to be a flaw of this new Israeli culture or Zionist culture or pioneer culture, for him, that was the heart of this whole endeavor, to hold them both together, to try somehow to hold them both together in a meaningful way. And it's not like being indecisive. No, it's leaving the tension that makes the whole thing worthy of. And I want to read a few lines. He says in an article that he published in 1936, he was, you know, 36 years old. Yeah. It's no accident that Zionism is a legal but rebellious daughter of the Jewish past, both rebels against it, its values of its Jewish heritage. The fundamental divide between Zionism and all its different opponents, from assimilationists to those who encourage conversion, is exactly around the issue of traditional values. And here he insists that, and this is very important, he insists on the importance of the present. The present is the moment that has the power to tie in a meaningful way the past and the future. And unless you recognize who you are at the present moment, it will never work. I mean, if you're fully committed to the past, then you are, I would say, alienated to your present. You're living your life as if you were your father. It can't work. So for him, recognizing your present moment and standing there fully and trying to live, you know, that past and looking forward, this is the big project. And this is also part of this, the few. So he says this tension in Zionism between the past and the future, or the past, is not an accident. We have to live it. We have to live in this tension. And this is what also gives it its power, right? The energy. Because if you left the past fully, you left completely. If you're committed to the past fully, then you're ruled by the past. You don't breathe. The only way of living fully is to stand at the present and looking back and forward and juggling between the two of them.
So Rani, yes. I love it so much, but I want to try to
yes.
to take it to the next step. So I think that one of the gifts of and this is why I'm so looking for, I'm so happy for this dialogue, because you're not only a scholar who is working, you know, only among books, but you also an educator. You are, it's much more than that. Like, you are educator in the meaning that you create language for people and for, right, for and to communities, to societies.
Trying.
In Israel, you're trying, I think, very well to give them the ability to think about their lives. So I think in our generation today, in the 21st century, for example, we are so influenced by the gifts of, let's say, mindfulness and meditation. So when you say present, I want to think about, like, so many listeners now that they are trying to understand what you exactly mean. So, yeah, so like when... For me, when you say, let's live the present, it means let's concentrate inside myself and listen to my body and listen to my voice that slowly I can find inside myself. But as you said, myself is also the culture, the language that my mother sang for me, the songs before I fall asleep, the stories of my ancestors. And this is what he means, that it's actually don't leave the Jewish past by when you have a question, you said like what my rabbis did in the past, or what the Jewish scholars, but listen deeply to yourself, but use the language. And if this is where Shlonsky is, I wonder, how do you teach Shlonsky today when so many Israelis, when they listen deep inside, maybe they are discommunicate from their past. So what do they hear? So help me here. I said many words, but I'm not sure I'm correct.
No, you're first of all, you're absolutely right. I think when people hear present, they think of something inward. Be present, right? It's like a very, but this is also, I think for him and also for his generation and peers, for sure, to be present is not only an inward look. He was very much interested in the condition of the Jewish people and in the condition of humans, of modern humans. And to be present is to look on where you are on all those levels, on the spiritual inner level, on your collective national and also, I would say, social level. He was very much identified with the socialist, you know, with the workers, with the workers' unions, all of that. But, you know, people didn't understand. He said, how can you be a Zionist? He left for Paris for a year to be in Paris. For him to live in Paris was to deeply inhale the condition of the human person in the 30s. And by the way, you know, Yakir, he has a fantastic description of Paris as a city where there are those all kinds of mythological, God is there, but he's not there. And he's dancing on the roofs. And one of the lines that I will now translate roughly into English says, in the streams of wisdom flows, or you find the waters of craziness. And he actually describes, he talks about the technology, right? The social media of his time. Now he is in the beginning of the 30s and he smelled somehow things that we know now, right? After the 20th century, that in 5 or 10 years, those medias would be influenced to the worst human endeavors, right, by Nazism. And he saw how telegraph and mass media can recruit thousands of people to the most awful. So you see, this is the present. The present is spiritual, but also very social and very much connected to your own group, but very much also generally human. Now, when you speak about language, it's also important to say, and it's connected to what I've just said, it's not only a linguistic term. You have to do. In that sense, it's very halachically Jewish, or, you know, very, you know, following some sort of actions. You cannot only talk. As much as he was a person of words, it had to be done in reality, not only in language. As much as he believed in language and worked with language, and in this fusion of language, take the old language, infuse it with new meaning, give it new life. It's good for you and it's good for the past, you know, because otherwise those words would stay archaeological. As to your question about teaching Shlonsky today, I think that part of his unpopular, I would say, position in Israeli culture today is that what he tried to bridge is exactly what is broken. Can I give you a
please.
An example?
Yes, okay. I love this sentence about the brokenness. So yes, please.
Okay, I'll read it to you. I would like to read it in Hebrew just for the sound, but I'll read it in English.
No, you maybe read for us one sentence, one line in Hebrew or two lines, and then go to the English, please.
Okay, so this is probably one of his most addressed poetical works that he wrote as a pioneer in the Jezreel Valley, end of the 20s. So I'll read two lines in Hebrew and then I'll go into it. So he says, "Halbishini ima kshera, ktonet pasim letiferet, ve'im shacharit hovilini elei amal. Dress me, good mother, in a splendorous coat of many colors, and with dawn, lead me to my toil. My land wraps in light like a prayer shawl. Houses stand like phylacteries, and like bands of phylacteries glide hand-laid asphalt roads." And then he continues. Now, this little stanza is striking because he's talking about he's like the voice of the writer and the voice of the poem is almost one. Okay, and he says, "Oh, mother, kosher mother, which is of course not a matter of taste, but a matter of her purity, if you wish. So it's okay. Dress me with the wonderful coat of Joseph. This is the reference.
Say a few words for people who.
Okay. Now this is the biblical story about the beautiful robe of Joseph that was crafted by his father, Jacob, as a token of his unconditional love to Joseph over his other brothers. Now, when I get to this point with Israeli kids or students, first of all, many times I have to explain the biblical connotation, which without you cannot understand the whole beauty of the poem. But when people do get the connotation, and by the way, most people, this is like a quite famous, the glorious robe of Joseph is quite, you know, it was even a show, right? And then I asked him, why would a pioneer in the 20s identify himself as Joseph? But this is exactly the thing, right? It's a paradoxical garment. It's a token of love by his father, but at the same time, a symbol of hate of his brothers to him, because later he would be thrown to the pit and the robe and the garment would be taken and put in blood and brought back to Jacob to show that he has gone, that he died. And for him and for his generation, that was exactly how they felt. They felt like Joseph. They were part of the Jewish family. And they were in their mindset, they were about to save all of the family, all of the people by coming to the land of Israel. They did not do it for themselves. They did it for, you know, to save the nation. At the same time, most of the nation despised them, at least. Or if not despised, simply ignored and went to other places, mainly to the States, of course. as a haven from Eastern Europe, from the pogroms and the cruelty and anti-Semitism. This is fantastic. If a person wants to say, I am the shaliach, right? I am the messenger. I am the savior. And at the same time, I'm a suffering savior. I'm suffering, or I'm being despised. Because the way to say it is to say, I'm Joseph. Because we know that at the end of the biblical story, the brother that all the others have despised and hated was the one who saved all of them in the years of hunger in Egypt. And it doesn't matter if it did happen historically or not. In our mythical mindset, this is Joseph. So this is, now what you asked me before is, do Israelis understand that? And I think that's part of the issue, that many of us don't. So this, what he tried to bring together, is many times broken, or the bridge has fallen apart. And this is part of what I'm and many of us are trying to bridge again, or to build again.
Love it so much. I really love it so much. By the way, did he write it after the Holocaust? No, it's before.
Fantastic question.
The feeling was there.
Yes, many people, you see, because this is also the moment that you say a robe with, you know, striped, this is like our first thing is not the Bible. Our first thing is Auschwitz.
Right.
But this is 1927.
Unbelievable.
It's not even closely in their horizon. So you can say, and maybe there was something prophetic here as well. I don't know, but because he certainly felt that being a writer, being a poet, has some prophetic features. Yes.
Rani, one of the things that fascinated me in your book and in his poetry, he gives language to things that sometimes we want to romanticize. And I feel that even that his poetry is so strong, and it's so, I don't have good words, it's so visceral. I feel that he tells you, don't make it look more beauty than it is. Feel the things. And one of them, and you mentioned before, his visit to Paris, and his general relationship between a person who lives in Tel Aviv, the new city, right, in Israel, but the life of the Zionists who are in the fields. As you said, he went to meet with them. He was with them. But many times, and again, this is what I love about your book, is that when we speak today in the 21st century about like nature and the tension between nature and the city, we speak about like nature is a place where we go to do, you know, a Buddhist retreat or a Christian contemplative prayer or Jewish, you know, holiday. But he speaks about nature as a place where your hands are in the ground and you come back home and your back is hurting. And the parents of this young generation are, look at them from Europe, and instead of becoming the next Freud, the next PhD, or go to America to make money or be spiritual, and you know, like the Yiddish mama there, I'm sure in their unconscious, they are working as, I will say, Eastern European goyim non-Jewish farmers. And he's there and he creates language. What's going on there in his poetry around that?
I want to quote first,
please,
because I think poetry has this magic that all our philosophies, and he says like this, just one line: man is flesh and he labors here in holiness, and bread comes from the earth. What can you say more? You're digging into the when he says he labors here in holiness, he doesn't talk about a shrine or a temple or a synagogue or nothing or a church. He's in the fields of the Jezreel Valley and he's toiling to get bread out of the land. And he's flesh, and that's holy. When you get bread out of the land, this is you're participating, and this is, by the way, amazing that when you compare his description of humans in nature while working in the valley to his life in Paris, that completely he was blown away. I mean, Paris simply, wow. He was in a big wow with Paris. But you can see that in Paris, this is all turmoil and cruelty. And God there is, you know, is hunting humans and is a sort of almost of the devil. It's uncertain whether God is if it's devilish or holish, you know, what's going on there? It's completely puzzling. In nature and in agriculture, this full participation of humans and God together in this, I would say, cosmic work and cosmic work. I don't speak about meditation, right? Listen to this again.
Yeah, he speaks about flesh. Oh,
flesh.
Oh, drops.
Sweat.
Yes.
Mamash. Look, listen to this. With shirt wide open. Now we have to understand this is all the description on one hand is very, very mundane. It's hot. It's the Middle East. It's summer. It's, I don't know how many says in Fahrenheit, but I don't know. It's almost 40. It's extremely hot. And he says with shirt wide open, like the open temple gates.
Unbelievable.
With the toes of my feet, I will caress the earth of morning. And listen to this, okay? I will lift my body in my palms and beneath the name of thick tree on a throne of green grass, I will sit, man, God. I don't know, maybe people who are coming from Christianity would hear, I don't know, people from all kinds of, would I don't know. And you know, you can interpret it in man. But woman, Adam Elohim, there is like a full harmony of God and humans here in this toil of the land.
And it's not God. It's like the word that he used is not Elohim. It's like Yahweh. It's like name of the divine that you seriously don't say.
Yeah, this is of course, this is crazy, right? Because he let himself use the name that was banned. But when you speak about, okay, tradition and revolution, what is going on here? Is this a secular revolution where a person is letting himself use the most holy names of all names in the Bible that was banned in most of Jewish tradition to be used? Now it's used in a poem of a socialist secular pioneer from the Jezreel Valley when he says, Adam Yud Hei Vav Hei, right? Like the crazy. So you said about nuanced. I think it's not that you're puzzled. It's not that I'm puzzled. This is the thing. It's like the mix is something that is giving this whole project the energy. Adam Elohim, right? Okay. So
my last question. We speak a lot about holiness and the profane. And one of the things that we all understand that in order to have something holy, you need to have something which is not holy, right? Otherwise, the Shabbat, the Saturday, is holy because the 6 days are the 6 days of work, which are the profane. But when you read for us these lines, he doesn't let you to go there.
So what I want to tell you.
Yeah.
What's going on? I think we could have gone here. Now, listen, this is also the beauty of Shlonsky's work is that he was not only doing this. I'm trying in my book also to show that, like in retrospect, right? 20 years after he was writing these poems, he's standing in front of his comrades. They're now celebrating 20 years to their pioneer adventure. And he's looking back right now and he says, oops. Too much holiness.
What does it mean?
Too much holiness.
What does it mean?
We have sanctified every goat, every move in the field, every spade, every, I don't know, every truck. Why? Because it was so hard that in order to give it some sort of force and commitment, we had to sanctify almost everything that we did there. But looking backwards, 20 years now that I'm 56, not yes. 36, I'm more than anxious that this might turn us on our heads. And he gives a fantastic example. He says, look on something which we know now from our days. Look on an Israeli army. Okay, it depends on your political position. You can, and of course, for him, it might be needed. We need to be defended, all of that. But to say that it's a holy army, to say that this is like a holy war,
secular people.
Yes, we should be very careful in sanctifying things that should not be sanctified. And he said this was looking back on himself. He in that speech where he criticizes the 1936 culture. He criticized the poem that I read you from about Joseph. And he said, this was maybe a fantastic poem, but it went too far. And we have not been able to establish some sort of a continuum between secularism and holiness because we needed it to keep us alive, to keep our heads over, you know, because it was so hard to simply survive. But now, the project is here. We have to be very, very mindful to the dangers that this brings into Israeli culture, society, and existence. And if I think that standing in 2021 and reading this from one of the major leaders of this movement in 1956, you say, wow, I mean, maybe this is prophecy. The prophecy is not only to be able to sanctify things, but also to criticize over-sanctification, the dangers of holiness, and things that maybe you have to be older and more, I don't know what, to look back and also sincere. I mean, there is some sort of sincerity here to say this was too much.
And maybe also to let the new generation who are now born in the state of Israel to not feel that their past, which is the parents who created the state and dedicate themselves, and many of them died to create the land and what's happened there, to force them not to be themselves, because the new generation needs to find their voice. To leave the kibbutz, right?
But I have to say, I'm very respectful to Shlonsky in that respect. I know from writings and his diary, it wasn't easy for him to do the transposition from being the rebellious son to be the one who's being rebelled, you know, rebelled against.
As the kid says, let it go in Frozen.
But he did understand that this is the way that it has to be. Mm-hmm. It has to be. It was hard for him personally to sometimes feel it. But I think conceptually, he understood that in order for culture to live, this rebellion of one generation and this rejuvenation, and if he was insisting of living his present, then his kids and his grandchildren have to live their present, as much as it may hinder his own, you know, greatness, you know, position and contribution, which did happen. And I feel I'm in a way his grandchild. So I can be calmer, right? I don't have to rebel anymore. I can look at him. First of all, he passed away 50 years. All the mythologies, I read the poetry and the writings, and I can address them from my perspective, from our perspective. And I think criticizing and loving, I would say that's the heritage, right? So
last question.
Yes.
As an educator, you work a lot with Palestinians or Israeli citizens. Did you ever brought this poetry to read with them? Because I think Shlonsky brings such a nuanced voice.
Many times, and I have to tell you,
I interviewed with American
educators.
Yeah.
Because I have a few translations, I read it in Europe. It's very interesting to see what turmoil starts in the room. Some people say, what? This is the secretion of tradition. You have to say, but this is a sanctification. This is too holy. What's going on here? Who is this guy, right? So I actually love the way that I think what people feel is when you read like one of the poems that I read to you is that if you put your hand on it, you feel the stitches.
You can actually
touch them, and maybe you can identify with the work of sewing things to of you know the attempt that might work or might not work, but trying to soothe things and soothing things together, I think that is something that you can identify with, and that's also why the conversation is many times so
alive,
so hot, right? Yeah. So it's stimulating a very hot discussion because people feel the project. They might not feel for his solution, but they feel the project. And I think in all sectors of Jewish society, I think in many sectors of art, you know, in many groups. In general, in many cultures, people can identify exactly with those questions, and he's doing it in an artistic craftsmanship, you know, in a fantastic way.
Yeah, touching the stitches. I love that so much. Rani Yeager, thank you so much for writing the book. Thank you for joining us to the New Books Network. It was
a
gift.
Thank you, Akir. It's always a pleasure and enlightening being with you.
Thank you.